Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Although it has become easy to be entertained by traveling Broadway musicals, thanks to Blumenthal Performing Arts' success with bringing top-tier tours to town, it is rare to have the opportunity to see a play. Rarer still to see one that is being incubated and given a kind of pre-Broadway exposure by the Blumenthal. But each time the Blumenthal has chosen to do that, those theatrical productions have been more than worth your time. And that is the case with a new play by Paul Oakley Stovall in residence at the Booth Playhouse through September the 7th. Immediate Family is that play. It has been described as Modern Family meets Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. It is truly a modern American story of coming to grips with changing times, dealing with the past, working through some sometimes difficult family dynamics, and tackling issues like race, sexuality, infidelity, and the smorgasbord of challenges we are all confronted with as we navigate our lives. Oh, and did I mention that Immediate Family manages to be laugh-out-loud funny while doing all of that? Well, it is. And you can credit the playwright for that, but credit must also go to the six actors who bring these situations to life under the deft direction of Tony Award winner Felicia Rashad. You may know her from her work on television as Claire Huxtable in The Cosby Show and more recently on Showtime's The Chi and HBO's The Gilded Age. And this hour, we have the opportunity to get to know her a little better. Felicia Rashad and Paul Oakley Stovall are both with us for the hour. Thank you for being here. Welcome to Charlotte, too. Congratulations on the play.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I saw the Saturday matinee, and I absolutely, thoroughly enjoyed it. I can't remember when I've had that experience where every, I don't know, 10 seconds to 15 seconds or so, I found myself laughing out loud at what was going on stage. You have managed to hit all the bases of modern life in just over 90 minutes in a way that seems organic and natural and completely recognizable, because these are family dynamics that we have all experienced at one time or another and in one way or another. But this could, Felicia, have descended into syrupy drama or sitcom, and it doesn't. It kind of straddles them both very carefully. How difficult was that to achieve?
Given the cast that we had, it was not so difficult at all. It just wasn't. What I look for is truth in human behavior. Because I think as human beings, we are naturally funny. So we don't have to work at it, you know. When we start working at it, that's when it becomes syrupy. That's when it becomes exaggerated. That's when it becomes something other than, for me, enjoyable and believable. So that's what I look for. And connections, connecting thought. From the present moment to the moment that happened before to the moment that comes afterwards, to what's happening 30 minutes later, connecting thought.
Paul, this is your work. You wrote this play, and it's not the first time it's been produced. It's not even the first time Felicia Rashad has directed it, but I would imagine that every time you do it, there are some changes, some refinements, some updates, because I think this play started life somewhere around 2011. How has this piece morphed over time?
Well, I expected there to be a lot more changes because it's been about 10 years since our production in Los Angeles. But, and I don't want to say happily, but I guess what just came to be was there were only small refinements necessary. And that means you've got yourself a hold of something that is timeless, right? It's not beholden to who is president or what city it's done in or what actors are doing it. So I was really pleased that the slight refinements were in rehearsals. Sometimes Felicia would yell, "Hey, playwright, come here. Let's change this word or let's, and that might have more to do with the space that we're in for the staging. It's going to take this actor a little longer to get over to this spot because of the, how large this stage is. Or, hey, playwright, come here. Did you ever notice that if she said it three times instead of two, there's sort of a rhythm in that? So just little, little things. And that's been nice.
And I read, I don't know if this is true or not, because you read a lot of things that simply aren't true, Felicia, but I read that you told Paul when you decided to direct this for the third time not to change anything until you got into rehearsal. True?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Why?
Well, because you need to be in the room with the actors. You need to hear them. You need to hear the work again before you start making changes. Otherwise, we're just making changes on the inside of our minds as opposed to what's happening in the room. And, you know, it's good to be in the room where it happens.
That's a famous phrase. Somebody ought to coin that. Over the last 13 years, this play has received numerous smaller productions. This one is Broadway caliber in every way. But getting a straight play to Broadway now would seem almost, seems like a gargantuan, almost impossible feat, given the nature of show business today. But is that the goal? Or is the goal here, Paul, simply to write a play that speaks to our times, that has elements in it that make it classic and timeless so that it can be done time and time again in various different productions regionally and around the country? What is the goal here when you sit down to write?
Well, quite simply, it's the latter. I'm really glad you came to me first with this because my goals as a human being have changed. I did think, and I think Felicia appropriately told me, hey, don't start changing things, because it was 10 years. So it's very tempting for a playwright to say, oh, 10 years, let me dust that thing off and make it better, so to speak. But I've changed over the last 10 years. And so the goal of Broadway and what that means is different to me, particularly watching the audience here in Charlotte, watching and listening to them listen to the show. And this area of the country take this show in. My goals are different. My goals are, I don't want to say smaller, but they're more specific and intense about how many people can we get to see the show, to get the message, to laugh, to go home a little lighter in spirit, and maybe speak to their family member with a little lighter spirit. And then that family member speaks to the child and lighter in spirit, and the child does better in school the next day. And then that, and that's the kind of change that's much more important than being on a marquee in Hell's Kitchen.
Right. And when a play becomes something that speaks to a lot of people for a long time, we're still doing Lorraine Hansberry, we're still doing plays by August Wilson, we're still doing plays by Tennessee Williams, we're still doing plays by Neil Simon. There's something about those plays that make them speak to audiences over a long period of time. Do you understand the secret, as a writer, do you understand the secret of that?
No, but I'm beginning to. And when you say those names, something really vibrates in me that is, it's an honor to just hear all those names and be having this conversation about this play. So I don't quite understand it yet, but, you know, put one's ego jumps into everything when you're a playwright. So the more I remove that and just say, let the words speak, I do begin to understand it.
And Felicia, you're not in the position where you have to direct anything that comes along. You can be very you can be very choosy about what work you want to participate in. What is it about this piece that you like enough to do it? Not once, but three times.
Family. That's what I like about it. Family. There is of course, you know, there are our individual families, right? And then there's that larger family of all humankind. Family is very important. And theatrically speaking, family makes for the best theater. Because we all have family.
And as I watched it, that's the overarching feeling that I got, that the people on stage, they may be black, they may be white, they may be living in Chicago in an urban setting, they may have all these different issues that they're confronting, but I knew every single one of them, and they are us.
You see?
Yeah. Of course.
Yes.
I know that you have, and we'll talk about this, Paul, that you struck up a relationship with Tom Gabbard. He is the CEO and president of Blumenthal Performing Arts, and he's been on the show 1,000 times. But you struck up a relationship with him over the years, and he was interested in producing this play in Charlotte, and they are the sole producer of this, but he wanted to wait until the time is right. And it didn't happen. And one day he called and said, I think the time is right. What makes the time right?
I mean, we'd have to squeeze Tom onto this for him to talk about it. I will say that, and I don't think I'm speaking out of turn, that I was actually in Charlotte and he was speaking to me face to face. I had just finished the touring stop, the run of Hamilton, and on the closing night, he and his wife Vicky took me for a meal, and he told me, you know, Paul, I wanted to do this in 2012 after the Goodman run, somewhere around there, but he had done a production of The Mountaintop, and the climate, I don't remember what was going on in the world, but the climate was such that it didn't go the way he wanted. And he got gun shy about bringing a play with these subject matters up front. And so it was just, you know, up to him when he felt, you know what, it's time. I think me being in town and him just, people evolve. You know, the only thing that's changed is us. The play has been the play for all these years.
Well, let's talk about that, because this play dates, I think, back to 2011. I think that was the first involvement. Professional production that you, and the first version of it that you directed, Felicia Rashad. And if the time is right now to do this again, is it just because it speaks to current events differently or similarly or how, in terms of how it's changed over from 2011 to 2025? And if so, how did you approach this in any different way than you have in the past, aside from different cast members? Felicia.
This was the first company that I cast entirely. In Chicago, the cast had already been set. In Los Angeles, most of that cast, I think, except for
two
characters, yes, were the same. But this cast was brand new. You're asking me about time and a right time. And a time is a very interesting subject and a very mysterious one at that. There are all kinds of definitions about time. And people make commentary about time. Time is so fluid, and yet time is so exacting. Time is gracious, and time can be something else other than gracious. Time is a very interesting subject. So in answer to your question, I think I don't fully understand what makes this the right time, except that it is.
The time is also up in this segment, so we have to take a break, and we'll come back on the other side and talk more about Immediate Family, which is at the Booth Playhouse through September the 7th. Felicia Rashad and playwright Paul Oakley Stovall, our guests at Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. Their curriculum aims to develop curiosity among middle schoolers and help them foster skills like critical thinking, collaboration, problem solving, and social awareness. More at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Immediate Family, the play in residence at the Booth Playhouse. It's in previews now. It opens officially on Thursday, and it's already been extended to September the 7th at the Booth Playhouse at Blumenthal. Felicia Rashad is the director. Paul Oakley Stovall is the playwright. They are both with us this morning. Both of you have been involved in lots of different aspects of theater and entertainment, including producing, and this production of Immediate Family is being solely produced by Blumenthal Performing Arts. They do this every once in a while, not very often, and usually with some success. Tom Gabbert has invested many times in Broadway shows that he believes in, and as a result of that, we in Charlotte have been the beneficiaries, because if you're a producer, you can kind of call the shots on where the first tours come, and we seem to get those first tours. But to be the sole producer of a show that's only going to sit on the stage at the Booth, which seats about 349 people, if I've got the number correct, that's a big investment. It's a lot of money. You could live in the house that they have constructed on that stage. It's gorgeous. Is there any idea to travel this production, Felicia? I mean, you're involved. You have the top caliber actors who have credits deep and broad. Any reason to think that this shouldn't or couldn't or will tour?
Well, I see no reason why it couldn't. I see no reason why it shouldn't. Whether it will or not is, well, it's not up to me. But I see no reason why it shouldn't or couldn't.
It really is that good. And these people are remarkable. You talked about this being the first time you fully cast the show. Because sometimes the show, as you say, is already cast. The director comes in and you have to deal with whom you have been dealt, the cards you've been dealt. What were you looking for in the people you cast this time around?
Well, I was looking for a cast of actors who would be open, certainly, who had a theatrical experience, definitely, and whom I would believe in these roles. Mm. Yeah.
And you told, Paul, you told the Charlotte Observer that the community that you most want to bring in to see this is the Southern Black community, because that, you say, is the community that moved north to places like Chicago, where this play is set during the Great Migration. And you want to see how this play will be perceived and received in the South. With the few performances that have already taken place with preview audiences, how has it been received and perceived?
Oh, I can move on to my next goal. It's been wonderful. They've received it and perceived it, just as I would have hoped and dreamed, with open hearts and with identifying themselves in it. That's been very nice. And so I move on to the goal of, I'll go back to my little corner, my little elf workshop corner of refinements, maybe another word here or there.
But this is not, I don't want to give people the impression that this is just a Black story and it's just for Black audiences. It is not. I sat there and watched this with a very mixed audience, and it spoke to everybody, because everybody reacted in their own way and in their own time to what they saw on the stage. People right. recognizing themselves in the characters, in the situations throughout the play. That's the important, that's the key ingredient to all of this, to this success. Why do you suppose it does work that way, Felicia? Is it just because it's about the human experience?
Exactly. Exactly. It's specific to these people who are in the play, yes, but specificity yields universality. When you're being very specific about human beings, you become universal, because we are much more alike than we could ever be different. And that's the only way I like to work. Oh, yeah, I'm not interested in anything else. I really am interested in my work prompting conversation and revealing that truth. Conversation about that truth and revealing that truth. And that's the I think that is the importance of art and certainly theater.
Yeah, most people know you as Claire Huxtable on The Cosby Show. That's where you came into the consciousness of most people, but you've been around for a long time before that. You've been doing a lot of things over your time in the theater and in television, etc. Does it bother you that that's what people remember you for because of the extensiveness of your experience and the deep thought that you have put into this show, which probably is not necessarily put into a sitcom on television?
Actually, it was put into that sitcom.
That's what made it so successful and universally popular.
Successful, because it was about the human beings. It was about people, you know. And it was written, directed, and performed with respect for the audience and the audience's intelligence. That was the goal. That was the goal, to respect the audience's intelligence.
As I say, most of our listeners know you as an actor, but you have extensive experience as a director, and your Broadway directorial debut for the play Purpose won the Tony for Best Play, as well as several other awards. An actor is responsible for serving the text and making sure the character is true to what the author's intent was, but a director is responsible for every performance. For molding, helping to mold every actor's performance, to bring those characters to life, make sure that they're all on the same page, in the same play at the same time. But after getting a taste of being in the spotlight at the early age of 11, vowing to become an actress, becoming one, what drew you to directing? Because that's behind the scenes.
It seems like it is, doesn't it? I say it seems like it because that's the appearance that I would like to have. I would like to make sure that my hand is so light that you never see it in a performance, you know, that you don't think about it in a performance. And yet it's there helping to shape and mold every aspect of it. What drew me to it specifically was an invitation from Constanza Romero, who was August Wilson's wife. She called one day to say that of all of his plays, Gem of the Ocean was the one that had not been presented at Seattle Rep. And now they were going to do a production, and would I direct it? And I was aghast because I had never thought about being a director. Although Jeffrey Holder said to us in the understudy rehearsal in The Wiz so many years before that every actor should think about becoming a director and a producer. And I just heard that and thought, yeah, that's nice. No. And yet it's what has happened.
I'm going to talk about that because you're dealing here with a cast of really highly trained, experienced professionals. And I guess I could ask an NFL football coach about the same thing, or an NBA coach about the same thing, because they're dealing with highly trained and professional athletes. What do you bring to the table? How do you communicate with them? How do you help these people who are artists in their own right, help them to do something without getting in their way?
I think being an actor helps because the language is different. When the director has experience as an actor, it's my experience as an actor, having worked with directors, the approach is different. The language is different. I understand that every actor has their own language. I watch before I speak. I think before I speak. And I begin the conversation with what would happen if.
And as a playwright, Paul, you are an actor. You have to speak other people's words. You're putting words into actors' mouths as a playwright. Is that how you write? Is that how you when you sit down to write? Do you think to yourself, how can I say this as an actor? Can I say these words and make them real?
Know that I think it right at the front of my lobe, so to speak, but I do have an actor's sense of rhythm I think, when I write. And sometimes I will overwrite because most actors want to have more lines. So you need a good director to say, you don't need that. Cut that. I can show that this way so that we don't have, otherwise it seems like it's echoing in the chamber and it's the point has been made already. So if anything, it's a matter of putting the right people around you to help you edit if you come at playwriting from an actor's point of view. But I do feel like I know the rhythms of how characters speak pretty well.
And I believe I'm correct in saying, Paul, that you have also directed. So you're a playwright, you're an actor, you're a director, and you're sitting in the rehearsal room with another director, Felicia Rashad, and it's your piece. And I'm sure that when you wrote this thing, you had an idea of what it should look like, what it should feel like, how the characters relate to each other, the rhythm of it all. How do you stay quiet?
Well, I knew nothing about directing all those times, those first productions. And I want to add, when you speak about Felicia, so it was for me a laboratory to learn. And now I've just directed Giovanni's Room, I've directed Gods and Monsters, and I blatantly steal, which I think Felicia will tell you is exactly what you should do when you're starting into directing, or, you know, steal from the best, right? I don't have any issue with sitting back and being quiet. I mean, Felicia might tell you different. That I want to chime in.
Felicia, you made a face.
But before she chimes in, I want to say one thing, Mike. Before she chimes in, you've been speaking about her directing, and what it takes. What it also takes is she's not just working with actors. So directors don't just work with actors. For you listeners out there, she's got a design team that she has to get everybody on the same page. She's got stage management, the crew, she has to get everybody on the same page. She's got to wrangle me. So the director is not just getting the actors to do their best work. It's the lighting has to come this way. I need that to be more subtle. The late, great John Iacovelli, I'll never forget the day I first saw his rendering of the set the first time we did it. And my heart started thumping in my chest because I realized, oh, he's telling my story too. Everybody has to be on the same page. And that's what something else the director has to be responsible for.
Since you've done this three times before, or twice before, Felicia, with different actors in different settings, on different sets, with different props, et cetera, different designers, how does that change a play? Each time you do it, how does that inform what the audience takes away, the performances that we see, the rhythm of the play, et cetera? How does it change it?
Ideally, it shouldn't. Ideally, none of those variables should change the play itself. We, of course, you know, we adapt to a different size of a stage. We adapt to spacing. Yeah, we adapt to, in this play, a different placement of, let's say, components of a set, okay? But it's a brand new cast. They're not having to adapt to anything. They're walking into, you know, so as a director, you walk into it also, because before that set was designed, there were meetings that were taken with that designer. Mm-hmm. There were renderings that were looked at, adjusted, discussed, refined. So it doesn't change the play. It should not change the play itself. And the play is the thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Another phrase that should be coined. They say, Paul Oakley Stovall, that a writer writes about what he or she knows. How close to home is this for you? How many of your family experiences, your personal experiences, are somehow secretly deposited in the lines of this play?
Oh, it's right around the corner, you know, from my heart. It's all there. There have been several relatives who come to see it and say, "Now, wait a minute." But it's hidden within, that's my cousin, and I've put that line in the body of the sister. So it's all in there. But more than anything, every character is me. You can't write, your opinion of what someone did and how that works. That will get into that territory where Felicia was talking about. It's not real. It's not true. It's not specific. So more than anything, every character in the play is me.
Except
in some aspect of me.
Except there are some writers, particularly I've noticed on television, who are fabulous writers, and the shows that they're involved in are marvels, but they sometimes have a tendency for every character to sound or speak in the same way, in this rapid-fire way. Every character in this play has their own cadence, have their own vocabulary, has their own approach to the situation that's very different. It is individualistic, and yet it all comes from you.
And well, some would say that means I have a personality disorder, and I wouldn't say
some would say that the actors have found something within.
Yes. You have to have a trust. It's a great leap of faith to put all of that out there and then hand it over. It's like when you have the child, and then the child is 5 years old, and they're on the first day of school, and they don't even look back to wave goodbye.
Yeah.
And because you trust that the other kids and the teachers in the building and the books they're reading are going to shape them, that you've made good choices, and now you just...
Well,
it's a great leap of faith.
I'm curious about that, because both of you have a vision in your head. You wrote it, you have a vision in your head of what it should be. When you sit down to direct something and you're working with actors, I'm sure that you have a vision of what you want to see on that stage. Sometimes that vision is fully realized. Sometimes the actors may take it in a different direction. Maybe they're not able to accomplish what you saw in your head and you have to adjust, etc. And then you have to deal with the fact that that is what it is. It's not what I saw, but it is what it is. Is that difficult for you, Felicia?
Okay, so I'm a mother, right? And we want to talk about difficulty. One of those things that I have learned as a mother is when to refrain, when to restrain. It's one of the most difficult lessons that I've had to learn. There comes a time when you must be silent.
Wow. We're not going to be silent. We have to take a break and be silent for 90 seconds, but we're going to come back and talk about some of the themes that are explored in Immediate Family, which is at the Booth Playhouse through September the 7th. Felicia Rashad and Paul Oakley Stovall, our guests on Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Felicia Rashad, who is the director of Immediate Family, and Paul Oakley Stovall, who is the playwright who wrote it. It's at the Booth Playhouse through September the 7th. They just extended the run, which is a very good sign, and although it's in previews, it officially opens on Thursday night. You can get tickets at blumenthalarts.org. We don't talk about every Broadway show or every show that comes to town, mostly the significant ones, and this is a significant one for many, many different reasons, not the least of which is that it's darned funny, and you will see yourself on that stage. As everybody knows, and I don't want to dwell on it, you were Felicia in The Cosby Show, which was a groundbreaking TV show for many of the reasons that we already talked about, but also because it portrayed Black families on TV in a way that was completely different from how they had been portrayed before. It normalized them. It made them part of the zeitgeist. They were no longer the other. And it got a little immediate negative reaction for that, because they said that the people didn't live like that. Black people didn't live like that. Well, clearly that is not true. And we found that out over time. Now you're dealing with the family living in the an upper middle class family in this play, living in Hyde Park in Chicago in a very comfortable setting. They are not the other either. Is that how you see it? Could advancing a broader understanding of this help the country?
Why should anyone be considered the other?
Right.
What is the root of this fallacy? Thought. One could say it's the lack of curiosity about each other. Being fed misinformation and just feasting on that, as opposed to being curious about one's own self, which would lead you to want to know more about other people. If you're really curious about your own self, you do want to know more about other people. So why should anyone be considered the other? One of the things that really I found very curious in the early stages of the Cosby Show were interviews in which I would be asked such a thing. Well, is this a realistic portrayal of a Black family? I mean, do Black people really live like this? And I was shocked at the question. I had to ask the interviewer, what year is this? I grew up in Houston, Texas. My father was a dentist. His colleagues, there were other dentists. I grew up in a community of professional people during a time of legal segregation. We were several communities within that city. Normal? Why would it be considered something other than normal? That's just fallacy of thinking.
That's why I wanted to ask the question, and that's, I think, why the Cosby Show was so groundbreaking, is that if you're not exposed to the reality of the lives people are living, and they are segregated because by design, you can't possibly understand them. And when you see it, you may go, that's not real at first, but when you see it repeatedly, as you do on television in a successful show, it becomes part of the culture. It becomes normal. It becomes normal. But you also understand things that you didn't understand before.
Yeah, you understand yourself in a setting that you thought was so foreign to you.
Mm-hmm.
You understand yourself and people whom you considered the other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You have said that you like engaging in work that has meaning for audiences, and this one certainly does. It hits on all kinds of themes that have the potential to make some members of the audience perhaps a little uncomfortable. And since the audience the day I saw this last Saturday afternoon was a mixture of Black and white, young and old, they were witnessing a discussion on that stage that includes race. It could have been uncomfortable. It could have been preachy. It was not. And the result was that the audience embraced it. And is that because of the script? Is it because of your direction? Is it because of the performances? Or all three, Felicia?
I think it's because of all three. And the work of the designers as well. And the work of the theater staff as well. Theater is community. It's collective. Theater is a collective. And we have all people working together. And we have collective intention to bring the best as an offering to our audience. I think it's everything and everyone working together that has made this so.
If there's an element of the other Paul in this play, it is one of the characters, Jesse. He's coming out to his sister. He's gay. She's quite rigid and devoutly religious. She has to deal with that and with the fact that not only is Jesse in a relationship with a guy, he's in a relationship with a white guy. And she has to also tolerate a half-sister who is half-white. None of that is new when it comes to some families. And even if that is new, everybody has quirks in their family that they have to learn to deal with. But I don't remember seeing many theatrical productions that use these as an opportunity for thought and for discussion while we're laughing at it. Because this is laugh out loud funny. How do you find the comedy in these really tense, difficult, real situations?
You know, Mike, I look no further than my own life. And I think that if we were all honest with ourselves, it comes back to the self, exploration of the self, that laughter gets us through many more situations than railing at the heavens or complaining or crying and yelling, screaming. Although I'll subtract crying, because as Leonardo da Vinci wrote, laughing and crying are two sides of the same coin. They operate within your body in the same way, this as a release of emotion. So I don't try too hard to write funny things. I think Felicia tapped on that earlier in the interview. You just tell the truth. What is the truth of the situation? And oftentimes, Mike, that ends up being very funny.
Yeah, and Neil Simon has this cadence that he writes where you set it up, you knock it down. You set it up, you knock it down. That's not the way this play works. It's just organically funny.
It's situational.
Yeah.
Each situation leads to the next. And the laugh out loud funny, yes, you know, I think, working with Foolish all these years, we don't go in thinking, got to get that laugh. Mm-hmm. If anything, it's the opposite. We just have to get that truth and let the chips fall where they may. We have to keep digging and digging. And the closer, the more you dig with great intent, collective intent, as you mentioned, you get closer to the vibration of that funny bone, so to speak.
Yeah.
And
truth is the essence of comedy. If it doesn't ring true, it is not funny. Only on the surface. Felicia, you've cropped up as a character this season on an increasingly popular HBO show called The Gilded Age, and you play a woman who is not unlike the lead character in this play. Very rigid. She's an aristocratic matriarch who is quite rigid and living at a time when high society had very rigid expectations of the people in their class. You, along with the great Audra McDonald and Denee Benton and others, are showing America another side of Black life that many people may have been completely unaware that there was an upper class, high society Black group of people, professionals, educated people, in New York and elsewhere. So what are you learning about these people? Did you know about them? What are you learning about them? And what is that teaching us today as audiences watch this?
Well, yes, I did know about it. I did know about it. I think what's very interesting is people's reactions, especially to Elizabeth Kirkland. That's the character that you're referring to. Mm-hmm. Her behavior and her actions based on her behavior. And I thought to myself, if this does nothing more than bring to light the ridiculousness of such behavior, it's been a good run and I've done a good turn, because the behavior is ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. Oh, it is. It's ridiculous. And yet there are people to this day who behave in this way. And they're serious about it and they mean it, but it's because of the belief system that they hold. So, you know, putting a crack in that wall is a good thing.
Paul, this is not your first time in Charlotte. As you said, you were here to play George Washington in the national tour of Hamilton, which I think I probably saw you in that. And you've done other things, including working for the Obama administration. And that was, I think, the first time that you were in Charlotte, because President Obama's second nomination came in Charlotte at the Democratic National Convention here. I'm just curious how a playwright, an actor, a person heavily involved in theater finds themselves 8 years in a White House administration.
Well, as my mother said to me, as she reacted to all of that happening, she said, we knew you were a theatrical kid, but I always knew it was more than that. You were just a wanderer. And as you know, as a mother, I had to resign myself to say, well, he's going to wander and explore the earth, both physically and spiritually, and it will lead him to many adventures. So my career was going just fine, but I was watching what was happening through the Facebook was real hot back then, and people were Facebook warriors saying we should do this, we should do that, but nobody was doing it. And I just kind of said, well, I'm going to go do it. And I can, you know, the career can, if it's meant to come back, it'll come back. But I want to help these people who I believe in, and I will do what I can, if that's folding chairs, if that's whatever it is. And it became more than that. And I found myself working as a media logistics coordinator.
For Michelle Obama, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What in your background prepared you for that?
Theater. Theater. As an actor, we can't visual. It's not everything. You know, text is mostly everything. But that first day we see the set for real.
Right.
We get a sense of, oh, that's what the living room looks like. Oh, that's what that doorway looks like. The pressure of theater, you know, the collective intent to get to accomplish a goal. And so we knew we had a deadline. We had 7 days to get something done, where each department is planning, and it comes together. And tomorrow is the rally speech or whatever it might be. So we would be teching, so to speak, but we just didn't get any preview performances. They come around the corner and it's opening night. That's it. Yeah. And we had two, you know, performers, so to speak, who really knew how to knock it out of the park every time.
For those people who were not living here or working downtown when the Democratic National Convention was here, it was very difficult to get downtown. We had a studio downtown, and it took forever to get to it in the morning because of the security and all the streets being closed. And for you, being an advanced person who needed to be downtown but couldn't stay within the inner city parameters because all those hotel rooms were taken, it became difficult. So Tom Gabbard let you and I think a few others sleep in the marvelous accommodations that are available in the basement of the Blumenthal.
That's right. We were in the Chorus dressing rooms, and Tom and his lovely wife, Vicky, provided air mattresses with sheets, standing lamps. Like, they created little stations. There, I had a team of four, so there were five of us all together. And we were able to make that our home in the Chorus ensemble dressing rooms of the Belk. Of course, how funny it was years later, I'd be back there doing Hamilton and to take the cast down, and I slept right there. Tom helped us out because, as you mentioned, it was impossible to get inside that perimeter with any kind of dexterity.
You have to take chances when you're an actor because your life is vague. It's not like working your way up in the bank. A job ends and you have to find a new job, and it happens a lot. You were, I think, working in Chicago, and for a theater company, and they were doing a play festival, and you were curious as to why your play hadn't been included in that play festival. So they asked if they could read it, and you said sure, and you went home and wrote it.
My play didn't exist. My ego existed, but my play didn't exist. Well, you know what, though? That's not necessarily true. I think the play existed. I just hadn't birthed it. I wouldn't have had the urge, the need to say, hey, my expression, my play needs to be seen, if it wasn't in there somewhere. So it was trying to tell me, hey, this is something else you can do. And this is your chance right now. And I was lucky to be amongst a group of colleagues who were fantastic and very open to hear what I had to say. We worked as a collective, and it was great.
I have about a minute left. This play came along at a time when the NAACP and President Obama had endorsed gay marriage. It opened in L.A. right after the Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage. Now we're at a time when LGBTQ rights are under intense scrutiny by the Trump administration. How do you think, Felicia, this affects what the audience is thinking about when they're watching this?
Of the people, by the people, and for the people. Let's remember that all the time. Of the people, by the people, for the people. Ultimately, it rests with the people.
Felicia Rashad, the director of Immediate Family, Paul Oakley Stovall, the playwright, both here in town until the play opens officially, although it's in preview performances every night at the Booth Playhouse at 7:30. It's been extended. The run has already been extended till September the 7th, but don't put it off. It's well worth your time. It's really wonderful. BlumenthalArts.org. Speaking of wonderful, thank you both for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.